You're listening to Retail Gets Real, brought to you by the National Retail Federation. Join us for a look inside the world's largest and most interesting industry. And now your host, Bill Thorne.
Welcome to another episode of Retail Gets Real, where we talk about things in an industry that impacts everyone, every day, everywhere. I'm joined today by my co-host, my friend, colleague, and the editor of Stores Magazine, Susan Retta. Hello, Susan.
Hey, Bill. How are you doing today?
I'm doing all right. How are you doing?
Doing well. Thank you.
We've got a very interesting episode today because we're going to be talking to someone who has their finger on the pulse of what's going on, not only just politically, but in policy and things in D.C. He's got a title, and that title is Senior Vice President of Government Affairs. That makes him a lobbyist. So we're going to be talking about lobbying. David French, welcome.
Thanks, Bill. Good to be here.
Well, glad to have you. So, David, tell us, lobbying. There's a lot of misconceptions out there about lobbying, what lobbyists do, the important role that they play. Tell us, what is lobbying?
Well, lobbying is really cool. It's actually written into the Constitution. You know, the First Amendment protects Americans' right to petition their government for redress of grievances. And what a lobbyist does is effectively serves as the intermediary between the American people and their government.
So when you talk about the American people, most would associate lobbying with big business. And that the American people themselves, they don't hire lobbyists, they elect elected officials. So is it a misconception? I mean, when you talk about representing the American people.
Well, there are all sorts of flavors of lobbyists. I mean, there are lobbyists who represent consumer groups. There are lobbyists who represent states and counties and cities. There are lobbyists who represent companies like, you know, retailers. And in effect, I might represent the companies in retail, but I'm also representing the millions of people that work in retail too. And, you know, what we're trying to do is aggregate those opinions. It's really hard for most people to come to Washington and participate in the process directly. So they hire lobbyists to act as intermediaries to participate in the process for them.
How do you get to become a lobbyist?
In my case, I failed as a busboy.
Yeah, I could see that.
Yeah. Did you really follow Alex P. Keaton as you were growing up?
Alex was my idol. Yeah.
I thought so.
Yeah.
That would make sense.
I also had a subscription to the Wall Street Journal at the age of 15 or so, and I was
classic.
Yeah.
Well, then your destiny was kind of set at a very early age, but you did do some time on Capitol Hill. You worked in the Senate, I believe.
Well, you make that sound like a prison sentence.
To some degree, at that point in time, at your age, it is a prison sentence. Low pay and long hours.
I worked on the House and the Senate side for 9 years. I really enjoyed it. Washington, especially Capitol Hill, is some of the most intelligent, driven, committed people that you can ever meet.
The staff.
But the lawmakers, too. I'm one of the most optimistic people in Washington. I think there are a lot of really good people engaged in public policy in Washington, and especially on Capitol Hill. It takes a lot of courage to run for office, and you have to really be committed. And these folks are really good people, and they're trying to do the right things. And so I've always enjoyed my experiences in the process directly, and then the on the outside, kind of looking in as a government relations professional. It's been really exciting.
I'm curious, you know, how did you end up in retail, for starters? And then what does a day in the life of a lobbyist look like? You know, do you start 9 a.m. walking up the steps of the Capitol?
Well, first of all, a lot of what lobbying is aggregating information. So I spend a lot of time talking to people on the phone, emailing with people, you know, checking in, trying to figure out what's going on. My day could start at 8 o'clock in the morning with a breakfast with a member of Congress or a senator or maybe a business meeting. Then I'll go and generally I check in the office, do some work around the office, talk to our members. A big part of my job is talking to our members. As a trade association lobbyist, there's politics on both sides. I'm politically engaged with our own members, and I'm politically engaged with members of Congress and senators on the Hill. Then typically I'll go to lunch. I just had lunch this afternoon. It was half of a sandwich from the corner bakery and a bag of chips. But, you know, we sat around and talked about the issues.
That was just like the riffraff.
Yeah, yeah. You were with the people.
It was really luxurious. It was a good sandwich.
But it was, who were you having lunch with?
Well, I was supposed to have lunch with a senator, but he got tied up in votes, and so I just had lunch with a bunch of other lobbyists, and you know, we talked amongst ourselves.
You know what? Lobbying is actually it's a lot of work. What makes a good lobbyist good?
Well, first of all, this helps knock down some of the misconceptions about lobbying. A good lobbyist is really ethical. Because you to be a good lobbyist, you have to have earned the trust of the people you're working with. And nobody on Capitol Hill will listen to you if they don't trust you. And in order to be trustworthy, you have to be able to represent both sides of the issue. People think lobbyists are trying to persuade members of Congress. We're not trying to persuade. We're educating members of Congress. We're sharing viewpoints. We're advocating. But if we can't accurately represent both sides of an issue, they won't trust us.
I find that really interesting because I thought, you know, thinking about some of the initiatives that are most important to retail, that you would have like a retail agenda as you're talking to these folks. I guess you do, but you're saying I'm not looking to...
I have an agenda, and I'm certainly trying to be effective in a lot of ways. Being a lobbyist is also like being a marketer. So I'm taking, you know, a good marketer knows they can't sell something to somebody who doesn't want to buy it. But they can help them understand, you know, how much they want to buy it through marketing. A lobbyist is kind of the same way. A good lobbyist understands, I can't change somebody's mind just by lobbying them. But if they're inclined to support my position, I can help them get to that decision quicker by providing them information. But I really have to effectively be able to provide both sides of the argument. And I have to understand both sides of the argument really well so that I understand what the parameters of the zone of potential agreement is with that member of Congress or that, you know, senator. And it's, you know, so a lot of being a lobbyist is being a good communicator, a good marketer, being clear in what you're saying, you know, efficient in delivering messages. We talk about, mm-hmm. We all talk about elevator pitches. You know, how do you boil your issue down to 30 seconds? You may only have 30 seconds to make the pitch. So you have to be really good at it. Twitter has been really good. I've now learned to boil my issue down to 140
Discipline.
Characters.
That's amazing.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, it's a lot of storytelling, and it's interesting because the success in retail right now is about good storytellers. Success in communication is about whether or not you can tell your story. And it sounds like you have to do storytelling as well to help folks on the Hill understand all the aspects.
Well, you know, the difficulty, I would think, and I may be wrong on this, but the diversity of membership that you have at the National Retail Federation, the diversity of retailers, you know, your online pure play, your brick and mortar, your small, your large, your restaurant, I mean, runs the gamut. How do you basically walk that very fine line where you're representing the interests of the industry and not just a small component of the industry?
And that's where being understanding the politics of trade association work and understanding that my job is political in both directions is really important. I have to help build a consensus among the retail industry of what are the priorities, what issues we should focus on, where are there, you know, common grounds to have an industry-wide position. I can't advocate on behalf of one company. That's not my job. My job is to advocate on behalf of the industry, and somebody else is advocating a different position. And, you know, we get into this public policy tug of war where we're trying to, you know, educate a member of Congress so they can make their own decision. But we have to have a firm position developed on the retail side, and we have to have a strong consensus behind that position.
It's not probably not a fair question, but I'm going to ask it anyway, which is, how do you think that retail is perceived by Congress, by the administration, by politicians?
Every member of Congress thinks they know a lot about retail because they shop every day. They're in a store, whether it's a 7-Eleven or, you know, a Macy's or a Walmart, they're in a store all the time. They think they know everything about it, and they know nothing. They don't understand. They don't understand how the distribution centers work, how the supply chain works. They don't understand, you know, the decisions that go into what's for sale and what's on sale. They don't understand how important data is. They don't understand how Retailers are reinventing themselves almost daily in order to go to market and find the consumer where the consumer wants to be found. They certainly don't understand the impact of mobile phones and tablets and you know, kind of the online ecosphere. Is that the right word?
Yeah. I'll take it.
Okay. They don't understand how that impacts retail. And it's no longer just a brick and mortar store anymore. It's everywhere.
I'm curious, when you have our e-commerce retailers and you have the traditional brick and mortar retailers, and they really have different political agendas, if you will, how can you sort of straddle the fence?
Well, it's being helped because there aren't as many pure play brick and mortar only, and there aren't as many pure play, you know, e-commerce. They're blurring the lines very quickly. So, you know, the differences are going away, you know, very rapidly.
When you worked on the Hill, were you working issues that are retail issues?
Not really. When I worked on the Hill, I was an agricultural LA, never been to a farm, had no idea what went on farms. And then one day my boss came in and he said, "How'd you like to work on the Ag Committee?" And I said, "Gee, boss, that sounds interesting, but I don't know anything about farming." So I worked for a Pennsylvania senator at the time, and we borrowed an agricultural economics professor from Penn State. And the senator and I both went to sort of ag econ school and learned a lot about how the process works. I learned how milk is priced and you know, so in that way, there was a retail impact to what I was doing. And my senator at the time, this is the mid-1990s, we wrote a farm bill. And, you know, he was very focused on agricultural policy reforms that were very consumer focused. They were designed to bring, you know, high quality food to consumers at lower prices and really take subsidies out of the system.
You know, it's interesting. We've had obviously similar experiences. And when I started on the Hill, I was working for a member and covering the banking committee. And I had to get a little book to help me understand what the difference was between a bank, a savings and loan, and a credit union. That's how, you know, basic my knowledge was. But you do, you work very long hours, you learn as much as you can, and you do the best job that you can.
Well, and most members of Congress hire really bright people who can absorb information.
There are exceptions.
There are exceptions. but really, I mean, this is why I'm so happy to work in this industry, because I'm exposed to really bright, really resourceful people. When I was on the Hill, I learned to absorb a lot of information in 2 or 3 hours. You know, I would meet with dozens of people and get all different viewpoints, and then be able to distill that down into a policy recommendation for my boss in a very short period of time. You know, was it the perfect policy recommendation? Not always, because sometimes I didn't have that much time. But I generally try to make the best, you know, use of all this information. And the information flows at staffers like a waterfall. It just doesn't stop. So it's a very exciting place to work.
When you invite other retailers to come up to the Hill with you, how do you prepare them for this? Because it's got to be completely foreign to them. It would be to me.
Well Susan, you made the right point. You know, everybody's trying to tell their story. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's how we're interacting with each other all over the place. And that's really how I coach retailers to think about approaching a Capitol Hill meeting. Tell your story. You know what retail, you know what goes on in a retail store. You know what goes on in a retailer's distribution centers. You know how the supply chain works. These are things they don't have access to. So you're a part-time lobbyist, but full-time retailer. You're an expert in retail. They know public policy, but they know nothing about retail. And so in order to make the right policy for retail, you have to marry the two, you know, points of view in a way that works.
Well, you know, that's interesting, because a few years ago, I remember doing a piece on healthcare, and I certainly do not have a good command of what's going on in healthcare from a political standpoint. But talking with a small business owner, and I remember having a conversation with Dave Ratner, who owns a pet store. I'm going to get the name of it wrong, so I won't even go there. But Dave was absolutely passionate about what he felt for his employees and how the changes that were being proposed would affect them. And suddenly it just became real. It just became something that I could absorb the same passion and write about.
Dave Soda in Pet City, and he's an 8-store retailer in Western Massachusetts. He's a great guy, great advocate, really funky business model, and he's a really smart marketer.
You know, you'd almost think that your job would be made easier, David, by the fact that every single member of Congress has a retailer in their district. They don't all have manufacturing plants. They don't all have large banks. Some have just credit unions. Some, have to travel long distance to get to the kind of services that others provide. But they all have retail. So how do you get that message across? It just seems to me that when you look at what they're doing and the impact that it's going to have, that it would just kind of be like the light bulb would go off, but then it doesn't. I don't understand that.
Well, in some ways, you know, retail is hiding in plain sight in all their districts. They see it so often, they take it for granted. There's sort of a romantic notion about manufacturing, the value of manufacturing jobs compared to service sector jobs, and retail jobs tend to be classified as service sector jobs. So there's a little bit of a hurdle to get over. They sort of take retail for granted. I will say most members of Congress really like their local retailers. They understand how valuable retail is in their communities. They know how retail, especially a strong retail footprint in their communities, makes it a good place to live, makes it a good place to work. You know, people need to shop. People like to shop. So, you know, you want a thriving retail community in your district, but they've sort of taken it for granted. We're helping to reimagine that conversation by talking about the value of the jobs, by talking about the wages that retail employees earn, by talking about the kinds of careers they make, and that's something we've been doing at the National Retail Federation for many years, working on the image of retail as a major employment and economic force in communities.
Can you recall a time where there was someone who you had been working with who just didn't seem to get it, and then all of a sudden something you said or some way that you connected in their community became a lightning bolt for them, and they began to really understand the depth of retail and the challenges?
Well, I'll tell you a story about swipe fee reform, and this goes back many, many years ago. Dick Durbin, who is a senator from Illinois and a strong retail supporter in the Senate. Dick Durbin was visiting his local grocer, and the grocer was educating him on how payments work and how expensive it is to process a credit card, because the banks overcharge.
Right.
And, you know, all of a sudden the light bulb went off for Dick Durbin. And he went from being kind of mildly interested in this issue to being a bulldog on it. And he has ever since been one of the strongest supporters for reform. And he saved, you know, merchants and our customers billions of dollars by helping us put competition into the market for debit card swipe.
So not only should we be taking retailers to Capitol Hill, we should be taking Capitol Hill to retail.
Absolutely. As a retailer, if you can bring a member of Congress into your store, mm-hmm. spend 15 minutes with them, you know, educate them how the process works, what's on your mind, it's valuable.
That's wonderful.
So what keeps you up at night, David?
The banks. You know, they are so pissed off that we won that battle over swipe fees, you know, in 2010. They've been coming after that ever since. That's fee income for them. You know, we think it's our customers' money, and you know we want to help liberate that money and put it back into, you know, into the marketplace through better pricing and better stores. But the banks think it's their money, and they're coming all the time.
Who's pushing out this narrative that that brick and mortar retail is dead or dying? I mean, is that a political thing, or do you just think that's people grab onto it and they just push it around?
No, I don't think it's a political thing. I think it's a narrative that is. There's been an overbuilding of retail. The amount of square footage in the United States devoted to retail is really high. So, just stipulate to that fact. Retail is also, you know, revolutionizing itself. I mentioned smartphones, tablets. They're certainly retail's much more ubiquitous, but it's ubiquitous without necessarily having to be on every corner in every mall. You can serve the same customers in many different formats now than you used to be able to. So I think the death of retail is certainly being oversold, and I think the death of brick and mortar retail is being oversold. I mean, Amazon is now opening stores, brick and mortar stores. Warby Parker, which started out as an online retailer, is now opening stores. These folks understand that they need stores in their mix in order to really expand their market share.
But do our political leaders really understand that, or are they caught up in the sky is falling?
Well, they're certainly sensitive to what is going on Main Street, and you know, when they drive down Main Street in their communities, if they see fewer rent or fewer retail stores, it registers. And there are certainly some malls in this country that are struggling, and you know, that real estate can be very valuable real estate. So they're also hearing from developers who are concerned that they're not making the rents that they used to be making. And so the retail ecosystem in communities is complicated. I mean, it's not just, you know, there's municipal revenues tied to this. So they're hearing potentially from a municipal leader like a mayor or city council about kind of what's going on with retail. But it's really been over exaggerated. I mean, the real truth about retail is the consumer's still there, they're still shopping. It's just in transition and moving in many different directions all at once.
I agree.
David, if you I don't know that anybody in elementary school or junior high or high school write an essay on why I want to be a lobbyist someday. If you weren't a lobbyist, what would you be?
I've always wanted to be a novelist.
You wanted to write?
I wanted to write, yeah. I had a typewriter. You know, I'd sit up late at night. I tried to teach myself how to smoke cigarettes because I thought that was kind of edgy. No, I've always wanted to be, I've always wanted to be a writer.
That's mysteries? Cool. Crime?
No, I wanted to write the great American novel.
Gotcha.
Yeah, I wanted to live a kind of a seedy life and third floor walk up in the meatpacking district in Manhattan and bang away on a typewriter and make something arty.
There are some of those out there that would say that by being a lobbyist you are leading a seedy life, but I don't agree with that. I just want you to know that. David, we're about out of time, and yet we have one more thing for you, and we call this rapid fire. We're going to ask you a question, and you're going to answer with the first thing that comes to the top of your head. You have no idea what these questions are, so get ready. Susan?
If you could switch places with one person for a week, who would it be?
Sean Spicer.
What's the last good book that you read? Did you say Sean Spicer?
I did.
Okay, let's go to the book. What's the last good book you read? Something about being a masochist? I don't know.
No, I like Sean. He has a tough job. The last good book I read. I'm reading a great book about the Battle of Dien Bien Phu called Hell in a Very Small Place by Bernard Fall.
Wow. Pizza or burgers?
Pizza.
So on your iPhone, what's the app that you cannot live without?
My Pittsburgh Penguins app.
I had a feeling you'd say that.
Oh, dear. Okay.
All right. On that note.
From a New York Rangers fan.
David, thank you so much for spending time with us and giving us kind of a look into what it means to be an advocate for the greatest industry in the world. And thank you for the work that you do on behalf of that industry.
Thank you.
We're going to post more information about the topics we discussed today on our website, retailgetsreal.com, where you can also find links to other episodes. And don't forget to subscribe and share the show with your colleagues and friends. You can find us on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, and Stitcher. And we will see you next time on Retail Gets Real.
You've been listening to Retail Gets Real, brought to you by NRF. For more information about the National Retail Federation, visit us online at nrf.com.